I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Fat Cats is the new novel from the writer George Mercer. This is the fourth in his series, Died in the Green. The stories take place in Canada's national parks, and this book takes place at British Columbia's Gulf Islands National Park Reserve. The park warden, John Halfcutt, sees a cougar that shows up as a chance to deal with the overabundance of deer. I'll get George to tell us what happens next, and as much as he'd like about his book, I'll also ask George about this series of books, his writing, and more. For more than three decades, George Mercer was a national park warden in Canada throughout the country. Originally from Newfoundland, Mr. Mercer now lives with his family in Saanich, where he joins me from today. Visit georgemercer.com for more. This book is also available on BC Ferries. Please welcome to the Planta on the Line program, George Mercer. Mr. Mercer, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
I really appreciate it, Joe. Thanks a lot for having me on.
You're very welcome. So one need not have read the first three books in the series, right?
No, you can actually pretty well jump into the series in anywhere. They're standalone stories, so you can pretty well start anywhere at all.
And then, so when we meet John Halfcutt, the park warden, what is he like? I mean, what do we need to know about him as we begin the book?
So John is John's a little bit of an older warden who's probably tired of some of the bureaucracy and thinks that there's simpler ways to do things. And after in Jasper, he got himself probably into a little bit of a fix there and was kind of forced to leave Jasper National Park. And he ended up leaving with his partner, who happened to be the park superintendent. And they find themselves in the Gulf Islands, and it's kind of a chance for him to make a new start. And his partner's kind of hoping that he does that without causing too much commotion, because she's hoping to help establish the new national park in the Gulf Islands and maybe eventually a national marine conservation area.
How does he view his job? I mean, you mentioned a moment ago he has been known to cause a commotion or two in his work. I guess how people view how he should do his job is a little bit different than how he envisions what his job should be.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, he's very passionate about parks and protected areas, very passionate about conservation and the environment. And I think, you know, in his past, he thinks that some of the things that parks have done or parks management have done haven't always been in the best interest of, say, the national park ideals and conservation and that. So he's, in Fat Cats, he turns out to be a little bit of a rogue park warden or biologist. He's sort of in a bit of a new role there, more of a biologist role, an ecologist role there, but he turns into a little bit of a rogue employee for his employers.
And so for people listening to us, when it's a national park, his employers is the government, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
And so that naturally brings up all our preconceptions about what working for the government is like. It's the bureaucracy that you have to deal with, as well as the outside interests of money as well.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the challenges that his partner, Ann Winters, has as the superintendent, is that she's trying to make John realize that there are lots of issues or lots of considerations that need to be thought about when they're trying to establish the new national park. And one of those is building relationships with neighbors and essentially not pissing anyone off, for lack of a better expression. Mm-hmm. And so John is willing to play the game, but there is a point, you know, where he's been working in the outfit for so long that he's sort of tired of some of the bureaucracy, and he's tired of sort of some of the roundabout ways of doing things, and he's more of a type of the guy that just wants to get her done.
So he is a park warden. And you were a park warden, right?
Mm-hmm.
What's a day like in that job, say?
Well, so I was a park warden, my wife and I both, actually, for 30-odd years, and depending on the park that you're in, the job can be quite different, but the job that John Halfcutt would be in Gulf Islands National Park would be essentially getting out into the park. He's trying to establish a long-term monitoring program for the park so that in the future they can look at progress made towards conservation goals, so trying to establish a baseline sort of the ecological state of the park. So a lot of it is getting out, doing field work. It's science-based, but it's very much technical, hands-on field work, monitoring things like songbirds and deer numbers, vegetation, it generally involves getting out by boat. You're often out on your own, in boat, landing on different islands, doing your surveys, and a day in the Gulf Islands is usually pretty sweet, and my mantra when I worked here was never cancel a field day, because even though the weather might not look that great, it often ends up being just like it is right now, early afternoon, beautiful and sunny and almost flat calm.
Mm-hmm. And so as Fat Cats begins, well, what, I guess we first meet a cougar, what are the challenges, say, that John faces in this book, say?
Yeah, so, the realization that John has is when he moves from a park like Jasper that has, quite healthy populations of, wolves and grizzly bears and cougars, predators, and ungulates like elk and deer and moose. And he gets to the Gulf Islands and he realizes that some of the islands, the ecology of the islands is really out of whack with huge deer numbers that are pretty well consuming everything from the forest floor to as high as they can reach into the forest canopy up a couple meters. And it's painfully obvious to John after a short time in the Gulf Islands that the lack of predators, species like cougars and wolves and to a certain extent bears that would have occupied the islands historically, has allowed, species like deer, black-tailed deer, but also introduced fallow deer, which are found on some of the islands, to just explode. And so, it's very obvious to him early on that in order to, a key part to restoring the ecology of the park for the long term is to restore the role of predators. And he happens to discover that a cougar, he finds tracks one day when he's out working, and from his work in Jasper, he's done quite a bit of cougar tracking, so he recognizes the tracks, and he realizes, a cougar has made its way, its own way, to the islands, and it's only going to do good here, so I'm going to leave well enough alone and not even mention it. That's the way Fat Cats really starts off, is John's discovery that a cougar has made it to one of the islands, and his purposeful, not saying it, telling anyone about it.
Yeah. Now, the when we hear, as we just heard you say, of an overabundance of deer, one would assume that culling its population, or controlling its population, I should say, it runs contrary to conservation. But I guess in terms of ecology, that's something that needs to happen, especially in a park like the Gulf Islands Park, right?
Yeah, exactly. And, more and more, Joe, like across the national park system, there's a realization, and, it's been a bit of an evolution in my thinking, too, but there's a realization that a number of parks lack predators or predators in the numbers that they would have been historically, and some of the populations of ungulates like deer and elk have sort of gotten out of hand. And moose, for example, in Gros Morne National Park in Newfoundland, an introduced species with no predators or largely no predators. Wolves were extirpated from the island. And moose have totally changed the dynamic of the forest ecosystems in Gros Morne. And in the Gulf Islands, native black-tailed deer without predation and introduced fallow deer, without predation, have really so altered the ecology that what gets impacted is, they're eating all this lower canopy vegetation that's really needed by certain species of songbirds, for example. So it ends up that you know, high deer numbers, no predators, actually impacts things like songbird populations. And the term is, you know, there's a cascading ecological impacts, you know, on other species that would rely on, you know, that understory canopy.
And that also affects, and not just, you know, other species, but obviously the vegetation itself, the landscape can be changed by the sort of animals that are there, right?
Yeah, if you were to, you know, take the ferry over to Sydney Spit, for instance, in the summer, you'd see a landscape. A few years ago, it has improved because there has been some culling of the fallow deer and that, and that needs to continue. But you'd see a landscape that looks manicured, you know, grass areas that look like they've been mowed, and a forest that's got, you know, all the trees trimmed up to about 2 meters high. And in fact, you know, I used to look out of the office window in Sydney across at one of the local parks where it was, you know, actively manicured, and I was thinking that the vegetation, like the gap between the grass and the base of the trees, the canopy of the trees, looked very much like it was on Sydney, only in Sydney it's not, you know, been manicured by us. It's been basically stripped of all the vegetation by deer.
Mm-hmm. Now, one would assume that because it's a national park, the land itself is protected, but throughout the series, I gather there is a dilemma, or there is a conflict, I should say, between conservation and development, and that's keenly felt at parks, is it?
Yeah, for sure, and I mean, that is one of the huge challenges in many of the parks. A lot of the parks, and, you know, you'll often hear the expression, you know, islands of green in a sea of development.
Mm-hmm.
And in many parks, basically right along the borders, it could be mining, oil and gas, forestry, you know, condominium or other recreational developments that butt up right against the border. And in many cases, many parks, you know, the big push is to try and manage the park as a protected area within, you know, the larger regional ecosystem. And for a long time, parks put a lot of effort into, you know, working with its neighbors to try and sort of manage for wide-ranging species like grizzly bears or woodland caribou. But there are also, besides those pressures external to the park, there are also lots of pressures inside the park to, you know, develop, have more developments, whether it's, you know, trails, infrastructure, campgrounds, in some cases, you know, backcountry lodges and resorts. There's a fairly wide range of development pressures in our national parks. And to a certain extent, you know, I would say that parks has held the line in some places, but, you know, certainly if you go to a national park like Banff, which still has huge intrinsic value, you know, especially if you just get off the highway and you don't see too many people, but, you know, the core areas of places like Banff and Jasper are so developed that you really start to lose, you know, the very values that the national park was set aside to establish, or established for in the first place.
And so who's responsible for the increasing pressure on that? It gets its moneyed interest on the government, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, there's, from my perspective, there's always pressure from developers, outside developers, to, you know, do things adjacent to or inside the boundaries of the park. And then there has been over the years, I think, a certain amount of appetite in parks to, you know, allow development to happen. And that sort of waxes and wanes depending on the government that's in power. I mean, there's certain things that are in the legislation that certain types of development aren't allowed. But it seems like there's always an effort to get parks to say yes to some new development. And, you know, I guess my position for many, many years has always been just say no, you know, because...
Right.
The more that you allow, the more you eat into the very fabric of why these places were set aside as national parks in the first place.
Yeah, and then the argument could also be made that this stuff needs to happen, otherwise people won't say, be in the park or use it. Now, that argument doesn't wash with you, obviously, because people, regardless of what sort of developments in the parks, they'll go anyway, right?
Yeah, I think overwhelmingly, like in surveys of Canadians, you know, most Canadians, I think it's like an 85 or 90% or more of Canadians that respond to these surveys say they want to see less development in the national parks. They want to see them remain as wild as possible, recognizing that everything else outside of the parks are being, you know, is being developed fairly aggressively, and the recognition that, you know, if you allow it inside as well, you are going to lose those things that people go to the parks for. There's definitely an argument to be made for human use, and you know, there are all kinds of, you know, low impact activities, hiking and you know, I'll say hiking and biking and skiing, mm-hmm. and you know, that horseback riding and that so on, that can happen in the park with, you know, fairly minimal development requirements.
Yeah.
And it's not about shutting people out of the parks, but there are certainly some parks where, you know, even the levels of human use have to be probably kept in check for certain times of the year, certain seasons, because in some cases they are, you know, I was just reading a piece about in the U.S. national parks, you know, the expression that they're being loved to death, you know, that just visitation is so high.
Yeah, yeah, it becomes a touristy thing, right?
Yeah, and I mean, it's great, like it's the big challenge, right? I mean, it's great that people, you know, want to visit our parks and hopefully want more parks and protected areas. You know, the big challenge is how to do it in a way that you still protect those values that the park was initially set aside to protect. And I think, you know, and I think that is something that's going to be probably the big challenge of the 21st century for parks and protected areas around the world.
Now, as I'm reading the book, I notice that when John goes out on his patrols, he has, you know, the obvious tools that one would need to conduct his work, the GPS being one of them. I guess it makes the job easier than say, it was for you 30 years or so ago, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. I mean, that's actually one of the exciting things I found through the course of my career. I remember the first day in Fort Smith and Wood Buffalo National Park in the Northwest Territories working with our contract pilot, and went into his office before we were about to go out on a flight, and he had a black box on his desk, and I said, you know, what is that? And he said, this is what they call a GPS. And we walked down the runway in Fort Smith for a few hundred meters and could watch, you know, the latitude and longitude changing on the box as we went along. It's quite exciting, actually, you know, through the course of my career to see the way technology has been integrated with the work that park wardens do, and things like, you know, GPS collars on wildlife, where we used to have what's called just a VHF collar, where you would actually go out and, you know, have to fly for those animals every week or 2 weeks or month and try and find an animal, and you know, to now being able to put on collars that you can upload the data to satellites or a cell phone and get really detailed information on what wildlife are doing. And that information is, you know, hugely valuable in how we then, you know, manage, you know, say, development and human use in the park, and give us a much better understanding of how, you know, various wildlife species use these parks at different times of the year.
The Dyed in the Green series, this is the fourth book in that series. This is the first fiction series about Canada's national parks, and the first book, I guess, came out in 2015. When did you start writing it, though?
So the reality for that one is I actually started writing it in the 1990s when we were in, we had left the north and went to Jasper National Park, but the story is set in Cape Breton Highlands, and it was really a profound experience sort of that we had in Cape Breton that sort of, you know, made me realize, you know, these are stories I need to get down. And when our kids were young, they'd go to bed and I would stay up till 3 a.m. I got Dyed in the Green written, but I kind of shelved it. I sort of did a little bit of, tried to push it towards a traditional publisher and that, but I really kind of shelved it. And it was as I was getting closer to retirement, that I did some fiction writing courses at UVic and Camosun College here on the island, and got a lot of encouragement from the instructor, and decided to, you know, pull it out and dust it off, and you know, finish it essentially, and have it edited, and go from there. And I sort of thought initially maybe it'd be one story, and then I decided, you know, Dyed in the Green is going to be a series. That'll be the title book. And then with the notion of a series that followed my characters across Canada, each one set in a different national park. And really it was, the idea was to use a fictional approach to get readers into stories about our national parks. People who might not read like a technical or a scientific piece or a nonfiction piece. And I just decided to take a fictional angle to attract those readers and help educate people about our national parks and hopefully do it in an entertaining way.
Now, what is it for you as a writer that you can say in nonfiction, that you, I'm sorry, that you can say in fiction, in these novels, that you couldn't say in a memoir or something, that a work of nonfiction?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, the thing for me was I'm not sure what it was, but I certainly got turned on to the notion of writing fiction. I think partly it's, you know, sort of the literary license you have to create characters and create set, you know, scenes and situations that actually are, in many cases, they're fictionalized accounts of experiences we had ourselves, and the characters are very much composites of people that I dealt with or worked with or met over the years. But, I find fiction does give you a freedom that maybe nonfiction doesn't allow you. But at the same time, I'm planning to write at the end of this series a book called Six Parks, The True Stories Behind the Series. And I actually think a lot of people will find the true stories more unbelievable than the fiction because, there are some great stories in, I'm just one warden who could tell a lot of stories about things that happened, but there are so many stories that different wardens have about their experiences, and some of them are like almost straight out of fiction, it seems.
if you wrote it in a novel, they wouldn't believe it, would they?
That, you know, that's kind of the thing. I mean, I think I tell stories sometimes, and people think, well, that's just BS, but... honestly, some of the stuff, particularly some of the things that happened in Cape Breton that led to Dyed in the Green, it was quite surreal, actually, some of our experiences. But then when I look back on all of the parks that we worked in, I would say, you know, we had pretty interesting experiences in all of them, and I don't begrudge a day of my career as a park warden. It was just a great parks were a great organization to work for. Despite some of the frustrations sometimes, and there was always interesting things to do.
Did you spend a lot of time thinking about the animals that you portray in the book, George?
Well, I had I've always had a strong interest in wildlife, and ranging from everything, you know, like from songbirds to bears and whales and so on. But I do put quite a bit of thought into it. I think I try as much as possible to, you know, put those animals in situations that I don't try to put my head into, like I don't try and anthropomorphize wildlife or whatever, but I do try and reflect wildlife behavior, things that they do around people and not around people, and you know, I guess a big part of the fat cats in particular, a big part of the story for me is trying to portray a cougar that's made it to this island where there's this bounty, untapped bounty of deer that's not wary of predators because they've never experienced predators. And the other part of it for me is also trying to give the reader a good sense of place so that, and these are all places that, you know, experienced and I feel I can describe quite well, but sense of place is a huge part of the story for me as well.
So there are two more books in the series, and I guess, have you finished the series yet?
So, yeah, I mean, I've got Dyed in the Green, Wood Buffalo, Jasper Wild, and now Fat Cats out, and my plan is I'm currently working on book 5. It's called Tidewaters, and it's going to be set in It's going to be sort of a split setting. I haven't sort of totally nailed that down, but it's going to be set in Terra Nova National Park in Newfoundland and Fundy National Park in New Brunswick. And the sixth and final book that I plan is in book three, I have my main character at the end of the story go to Tanzania on an exchange with an African ranger. And book six, I'm hoping to write called The Rhino's Horn, to bring that story around sort of full circle and to get people back to Ben Matthews, one of the main characters, and what happens with him in Africa, and the idea of incorporating an international component that talks about elephant and rhinoceros poaching and some of the challenges. You know, poaching is not only an issue in, well, it's an issue globally,
yeah,
and probably more so an issue in places like Africa than it is in any of our Canadian national parks.
Not considering the last book for a moment,
right,
and just talking about the Canadian experience that you've had and that you depict in these books, you're unique in that you've had this opportunity to see this country and the various parts of the country. I understand that you are originally from Newfoundland and have lived out here for a while but you've been up north, and when you have had this chance to see the countries you have, what do you make of its future?
Oh, this is where I get a little emotional, but I'm incredibly optimistic about, I mean, we live in a great country. We live in an incredibly diverse country, both from a historical, cultural, First Nations, ecological perspective, so many different perspectives. We live in an amazing country. I feel incredibly privileged to have been able to see big parts of this country, as a Parks Canada employee, and I do feel I'm in a unique position to tell these stories. I mean, there are other people who have moved around as much as we have and who have experienced places that we haven't been to, I'm very positive. I mean, we have some huge challenges. We have to try and protect more of the landscape of this country. In particular, we have to really put a push on protecting our marine areas. A couple of years ago, last year, I was on the Canada C3 expedition for 150th anniversary,
mm-hmm,
a boat that went from the Great Lakes to the East Coast, around the Arctic, to back to Victoria, down the West Coast, and I was on just one leg of that in the Maritimes. But, we are a country coast to coast to coast that's incredibly diverse. And yeah, I'm optimistic. I think there's lots to do to protect all of our three oceans. There's a lot to do to protect underrepresented landscapes in Canada. We can always do more, and more needs to be done. But I think it's possible. You know, that will get done in the next few decades, I hope.
Yeah, I mean, for everything that we complain about. And I'm sure this is the case where you live. I'm in Vancouver, but how bloody expensive it is to live here. All the problems that we have politically and otherwise, it remains. And I get this as I read Fat Cats. It is a very special place, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, not just the areas that are protected within national parks. There are some days in some parks that you think, you know, maybe it wasn't such a good idea to establish this as a national park, because now we've got so many people coming here and there's so many pressures on it. But whether within or outside our parks and protected areas, you know, there is a lot of amazing country that, Canadians can experience. And I would say, there's lots of places, beautiful places and amazing places everywhere on the planet. But, you know, this is the country, or this is the piece of it that we're responsible for. And I think that, I think we've done a pretty good job with protecting places with national parks and other protected areas. there's more to be done, but at the end of the day, it's all pretty special.
And if you've inspired someone to want to go out and see their national park, the closest one to wherever they are in this country, I mean, it's probably worth it as well for you, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, that's exactly it. I mean, I think there's different ways, Joe, to experience it. I mean, to a certain extent, like I said before, you know, there are challenges in some of the parks with having too many people at certain times of the year, and I think Parks Canada needs to do a better job of managing that use. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I get a great deal of satisfaction from, you know, more and more. I've just done 4 Christmas markets, and increasingly I'm getting people coming up to me and saying, you know, I just read your book. I didn't really know much about that place, and I learned quite a bit from it, and I'd like to go there. You know, I think the books take them there. Some of them want to experience it personally and get there, and then others, you know, through the various forms of social media and so on, you know, I think are learning more and more about these places. But for sure, you know, within limits, but
right.
I definitely want to see people experience our national parks, and not only that, but, you know, a lot of the great areas that are still left in this country.
Indeed. George, it was such a pleasure to speak with you today. Continued good luck with Fat Cats and all your future books. Thanks for this.
Hey, thanks very much, Joe. I appreciate it. And you can let your listeners know that the books are available in independent stores across the country. They're also available from Indigo and Amazon. And if people want to email me at my website, it's just georgemercer.com.
Visit georgemercer.com for more information on this book, Fat Cats, as well as his other writing. George Mercer joined me on the line from North Saanich, British Columbia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plante.